and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Josh Miller.
And I'm Tia Miller, and we live in Gibbstown, New Jersey.
I pastor the great people at Kingsway Baptist Church.
And I'm his happy helpmeet.
We've listened to the world and everything in it nearly every day since its inception.
We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Those old vinyl records you used to love so much, well, they're selling like crazy.
I like the whole process of putting the record on the record table and, you know, having the music come out of the grooves.
Also today, China uses technology to control its population, but now military use of it has some in the intelligence community concerned. Plus, the search for one of the strangest creatures on Earth, a mammal that lays eggs.
I think I've seen platypus on maybe half a dozen occasions.
And playing Yahtzee at the diner.
It's Tuesday, January 11th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Riker.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Time now for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
American diplomats flew out of Geneva empty-handed on Monday after almost 8 hours of talks with Russian leaders. Both sides said the aim of the talks was to ease tensions between Moscow and the West, but the meeting ended without progress. For its part, Russia downplayed its threat to Ukraine, Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov.
We have no intention to invade Ukraine.
But the White House said Russia should back up its words with action. Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
There are 100,000 troops at the border now, obviously returning those troops to the barracks, conveying to us their intention of doing that would be easy ways to show de-escalation.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has demanded guarantees that Ukraine will never be allowed to join the NATO Defense Alliance. And he says he wants the NATO issue resolved this month. Western leaders are worried that Putin really set the deadline as a pretext to launch an invasion into Ukraine if his demands are not met. Russia will hold another round of talks, this time with NATO leaders in Brussels tomorrow. Also on Monday, Putin declared victory in Kazakhstan. He said Russian forces helped to quell a terrorist uprising. That's how he described a week of protests in Kazakhstan, some of which turned violent. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
In the country's biggest city, Almaty, the streets were nearly clear of protesters on Monday for the first time in a week. Russia deployed what it called a peacekeeping force to Kazakhstan last Thursday to restore order. Police in Kazakhstan detained nearly 8,000 people in the worst unrest the ex-Soviet nation has seen in three decades. Some protesters set fire to government buildings and attacked police. But government forces also stand accused of opening fire on peaceful protesters. The country's health ministry said 164 people died in the violence. Demonstrators were angry about a lot of things, but sharply rising energy prices triggered the uprising. In a concession, the government announced a 180-day price cap on vehicle fuel and a freeze on utility rate increases. As the unrest mounted, the ministerial cabinet resigned and other high-ranking officials were replaced. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
The explosion of Omicron infections in the United States is interrupting services across the country, with more and more workers calling in sick. Employee shortages have caused subway delays in New York City. In Los Angeles, firefighters have had to transport patients to hospitals, with ambulance companies understaffed. And airport officials recently shut down security checkpoints at a terminal in Phoenix. And, of course, airlines have been canceling flights en masse for weeks. Dr. Peter Hotez with the Baylor College of Medicine told CNN.
Much of our hospital workforce is getting knocked out at home with symptomatic COVID.
And he added that there aren't enough COVID-19 tests to keep up with all the new infections.
When you add up all of that together, we've got a very serious situation facing our nation this month.
Andrew Hunter, senior economist with Capital Economics, calculated that as many as 5 million U.S. workers stayed home last week. And that's with employers already shorthanded across the country. New York City officials are revising the death toll from a fire at a high-rise apartment building. Mayor Eric Adams told reporters on Monday.
We have 17 lost, 9 are adults and 8 are children.
Officials originally said 19 people had died. Karen DeJesus lived on the third floor of the building. She said false alarms were so frequent there that nobody paid attention to the alarm when a fire actually did break out.
So many of us were used to hearing that fire alarm go off, so it was like second nature to us. Okay, not until I actually seen the smoke coming in the door, I realized it was a real fire and I heard people yelling, help, help, help.
A malfunctioning space heater apparently started the fire on Sunday, but officials say the fire itself was not all that deadly. It was the smoke. Smoke inhalation caused most of the deaths, and investigators are trying to determine why safety doors failed to close when the fire broke out. That failure allowed thick smoke to rise through the tower. Former Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi is facing more time behind bars. A court in Myanmar, now controlled by the country's military after a coup last year, just handed down an additional sentence. World's Josh Schumacher has that story.
This time, the government said Suu Kyi is guilty of violating coronavirus restrictions and illegally importing and possessing walkie-talkies. The military-ruled courts already hit her with a similar 4-year sentence last month for supposedly inciting dissent and breaching COVID-19 restrictions, but the military junta later reduced the sentence by half. The court has lined up a range of additional charges that the U.S. government says are trumped up. Suu Kyi could still face a lifetime prison sentence if convicted on additional charges. The military arrested Suu Kyi before the coup in February of last year. Reporting for World, I'm Josh Schumacher.
And I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, a surprising musical trend, plus the search for an elusive animal. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 11th of January, 2022. So glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up today, records.
WLS to ELO and Live and Sing from New World Record with John Records Landecker. Chances to win tonight. Listen for the music radio touch tone at WLS.
Oh, man, my favorite DJ. Records truly was his middle name, or so he said.
So he said. Now that brings back some memories, doesn't it?
Right. Well, hey, what were some of the favorite records you had back in the day?
Okay, every Beatles record ever made.
Oh, yeah.
And also the first album I bought with my very own money. I was 9 years old, the Tapestry album by Carole King. Great tunes on that album, like You've Got a Friend, It's Too Late. You know, it was just a great album. How about you?
Oh, I loved anything from the Eagles. I loved Fleetwood Mac. Remember that record, Rumors, the album?
Absolutely.
I won that one from a radio station back then, very simply by being caller number 16 to 969-6363.
Well, good for you. You know, I haven't played a record since the needle wore out on my stereo set.
I'll tell you what, I think it may be time to invest in a new one because, believe it or not, vinyls are making a comeback. World's Ooh. Caleb Records Bailey reports.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I like the whole process of putting the record on the record table and, you know, having the music come out of the grooves.
It feels warmer.
Music lovers at Harvest Records in Asheville, North Carolina are leafing through rows of vinyl records. Sure, streaming the latest hits on their phones might be more convenient, but these shoppers say it's just not the same.
Taking the time out to pull it out of the sleeve and to brush it off, and it's just a personal time.
And that love for vinyl is creating a music revolution. According to the Recording Industry of America, more people bought records than CDs last year. That's the first time that's happened since 1986. And it's not baby boomers who are suddenly trying to grow their music collections. Younger generations are the driving force behind the latest boom in vinyl. Jim Henderson co-owns Amoeba Records in Los Angeles, California.
You see a lot more people that are kind of interested in stepping away from what they've known and experienced through this one-touch listening world. And that's, I think, a lot to do with this, is that there's a youth movement driving the vinyl resurgence.
Vinyl's popularity began to wane when cassette tapes peaked in the late 1980s. Around the same time, CDs hit the market. They began to dominate in the 90s and early 2000s, and they quickly eclipsed both records and tapes as a revolutionary way to play music.
They were just attractive and smaller and, you know, spoke to kind of where things were at that time in our lives. Everything was getting streamlined and slick, and technology was kind of, you know, bustling.
But stores like Amoeba kept the turntables spinning. Henderson continued to stock the shelves with whatever LPs he could get his hands on, even though the audience was a niche group.
We still devoted, you know, a massive amount of our floor space all the way through it, through the 90s, when people weren't even really producing new LPs on a massive scale. Because it is such a great product, and because people do have a relationship with the product that you don't have with CDs or MP3s or, you know, any other formats.
So what makes vinyl so special? And what's driving such a vibrant comeback for an outdated and cumbersome style of playing music? Jeff Askew is a professor of guitar and commercial music at Biola University in La Mirada, California.
I think for just the average consumer, it's just something tangible. You know, you can actually hang on to it and you really appreciate it.
Digital music doesn't create the same sense of possession.
I think the biggest difference is that it's not tangible. It's just in the ether. And I think it's great to have all of that accessible, but really, fans of music don't connect that way.
Whether it's the jackets that the records come in with the album art and details about the musicians, or the sound of the needle hitting the grooves, Askew says the true music lovers can't find a better experience.
As soon as I hear vinyl, it's the crackle of the needle itself that's actually an experience. It feels like, oh, wow, I'm experiencing this right now, and I'm in control of it, and I get to tactically hear how this mechanical thing is working.
Even the experience of going into a shop like Amoeba proves to be a selling point for vinyls.
Yeah, I mean, you go to Amoeba and all of a sudden you've got plethora of music. I mean, there's just tons of stuff available, but it's really cool when you kind of just can zone in. You can look at it. You can see what artists they're maybe related to in the record, you know, store. I think it's nice. I actually really going to those stores and just like shopping.
Now, vinyl records still face fierce competition from streaming platforms. Spotify, YouTube, and Apple Music have 487 million subscribers combined, with a revenue of more than $13 billion. Revenue from vinyl records topped just $626 million last year. But Askew says vinyl record releases are a plus for musicians.
So if you look at the historical record, you know, contracts, they were getting paid by the unit and by just sales, physical sales, and they were getting a large chunk of that. That was the main way they were going to make their income.
With streaming platforms, only a small percentage of the proceeds goes to the artist.
So you have to have over a million streams in order to make minimum wage, and that's not realistic for most musicians, and you know, why would you want to go into it?
Thanks to the popularity of vinyl, artists are now planning album releases around vinyl availability, and that growing demand has led to shortages of the raw material and back orders. Some artists, including big names like Taylor Swift, are pushing back album release dates until the vinyl is available. Jeff Askew says that's good news for the entire music industry.
I love the fact that there's a way that they can, you know, monetize, because I want great artists and I want great music out there. I think this is the method to get it.
Reporting for World, I'm Caleb Bailey in Asheville, North Carolina.
Up next, frightening technology in China. The Chinese Communist government is using technology in unsettling ways, largely to surveil and control its people. But its apparent military development of unconventional technology has some in the intelligence community concerned.
Right, the Commerce Department recently blacklisted China's Academy of Military Medical Sciences and nearly a dozen research institutes. The U.S. government accuses them of using technology to support Chinese military end uses, including, quoting here, purported brain control weaponry. Here now to help us understand what that means is Craig Singleton. He spent more than a decade serving in sensitive national security roles with the U.S. government. He briefed federal law enforcement, the U.S. military, Congress, and the White House on a wide range of issues.
Today, he is an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he analyzes competition with China. Craig, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start with this. What is brain control weaponry? What kinds of weapons might these be, and what do they do?
So brain control weaponry is a term that's been used by the Chinese Academy of Military Medical Sciences to describe equipment that interferes with and controls human consciousness during combat operations. So this field of research is also closely related to China's development of other biotechnologies with future military applications, including things like gene editing, human performance enhancement, and brain-machine interfaces.
The Washington Times recently reported that it obtained three Chinese military reports, and one report had this sentence, quoting, "War has started to shift from the pursuit of destroying bodies to paralyzing and controlling the opponent." Now, that does not sound good. What does that mean?
Well, just like the U.S. military, you know, Chinese military planners routinely publish different white papers. Not all of the ideas put forward are eventually operationalized, but more often than not, I would say they reflect, you know, internal deliberations occurring in the Chinese military apparatus. And although China has been steadily improving its military capabilities for about the last decade, there is a sense in Beijing that a head-to-head conflict with a near-peer competitor like the United States could be devastating for Chinese forces. Remember, the Chinese military is never actually, it doesn't actually have combat experience, unlike the U.S. military. So China is looking for natural ways to sort of asymmetrically level the playing field with the United States, which is why ideas like these are top of mind for Chinese military planners.
How close is this technology from being put to use on the battlefield, so to speak?
Well, it's a new and emerging field for sure. So in many respects, the sky is the limit in terms of how this new technology could be reasonably operationalized during war. But yes, there is some concern that things like brain implants could allow for tactical operations to be conducted without necessarily pulling a trigger. Could you launch a missile via brainwaves? Could an operator launch, say, a swarm of drones with a single thought or beam images from one brain to another? I mean, it is sort of the stuff of science fiction. And so the idea that you could potentially surgically implant pieces of technical gear into the brains of a soldier or an operator from a foreign country, or even here in the United States. We have sophisticated programming going on here in America to sort of figure out what is this new and emerging field? Can it be operationalized? Is it safe? A lot of those same scientific guardrails don't exist in China. And so there just are concerns about how China could potentially use this type of technology, especially as we've seen an increasingly more belligerent and aggressive Chinese posture throughout the Indo-Pacific.
Craig, what must the United States and the West as a whole do to defend against developing threats like these ones that we're talking about?
I would say, by and large, you know, there's broad consensus in the policy community that more must be done to blunt China's ability to weaponize U.S. technology and know-how to advance its military modernization. You know, some of those efforts are defensive, such as cutting off China's pathways to obtaining foundational information about these new and emerging fields. Other measures are more offensive in nature. I would say key to both strategies, though, is a very clear-eyed assessment that China, like Russia, is working to challenge the rules-based international order that was put into place after World War II. That global infrastructure is under enormous strain right now, and it's far from perfect. But ultimately, I would say we have to embrace an approach that leverages partners and allies. So in other words, we can't do this alone. And as it relates to new and emerging tech, that means partnering with Europe, Japan, India, Australia, and other countries to ensure that global tech standards reflect Western interests and values. In effect, doing what we can to prevent countries like China from further weaponizing new technologies for use against its own people and increasingly foreigners.
Final question here, Craig. This is all pretty alarming stuff to hear about. Given your research, is there anything the average person ought to know about this whole topic that perhaps I haven't asked you about?
I would say that immediately our minds go to the darkest corners when we hear things like brain control weaponry, and there is reason for concern and alarm. The good news, though, is that the government, the U.S. government in particular, and increasingly foreign countries are paying attention to this issue and are willing to take steps to cut off China's pathways to obtain this sort of information and this technology. And that was not always the case. A lot of these developments are new or feel new right now, but China's been modernizing its military for over a decade, and we're starting to finally see consensus between both sides of Democrats and Republicans, both sides of the aisle, that no longer can sort of these things not be addressed. And then it's vitally important that this might be one of the few areas in foreign policy where both Democrats and Republicans see eye to eye.
Some good news then. Very good. Craig Singleton has been our guest this morning. Craig, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Additional support comes from Beyond the Forum, a podcast by the Veritas Forum. Season 2 on Science and God explores the ideas that shape our lives. Available now wherever you listen to podcasts. And from Trivan. From concept to completion, Trivan builds amazing specialty vehicles designed and manufactured in the USA. Trivan.com.
Numerous companies have COVID-19 tests on the market, but the most accurate test was created by our creator. So here's the story. Captain Paul Douglas serves on the K-9 team with the Bristol County, Massachusetts Sheriff's Department. He told TV station WBZ,
"Whether it's the Omicron, whether it's the Delta, you know, our dogs will hit on it."
I love that. Our dogs. And these one-year-old dogs are sniffing out the virus at multiple schools in the county. The canines are not responsible for finding the virus in humans. Dogs can do that with some diseases, but these canine cops are busting the virus on surfaces, everything from desks to doorknobs. If there is a surface that needs sanitizing, these pups will find it.
We'll go right in the classroom if there's students in there, and our dogs actually work right through it. They just walk through, they'll go over the backpacks, you know, they'll go around the teachers.
Florida International University launched the K-9 COVID detection program. They say the dogs can detect the virus with 99% accuracy.
Wow.
99. That is the best test available by far. These dogs are wicked smart. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Tuesday, January 11th. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad to have you along today. Good morning. I'm Nick Eichert.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, looking for the platypus. Last year, and for the first time, the Australian state of Victoria listed the platypus as a vulnerable species. Hundreds of volunteers jumped in to find out where platypi. Hey, Nick, what's the plural of platypus? I don't know.
Hey, actually know this one. It's platypuses.
You would know that.
Well, hey, you know, it's just the age of my kids. That's it. Perry the platypus was a favorite at our house.
Ah, okay, that explains it. Well, to catalog where platypuses live to help them survive, world correspondent Amy Lewis joined a search and brings us this story.
I mean, they're a semi-aquatic, duck-billed, egg-laying, venomous mammal.
Josh Griffiths is a wildlife ecologist with EnviroDNA in Victoria. He's describing one of God's most intriguing creations.
I think the more that I've done with platypuses, the more you realise how little is actually known about them. So a lot's known about their biology and their behaviour and so forth, but just understanding how populations are going. For me, I guess that's what's interesting. It's, you know, almost every time we do a survey or, you know, I catch a platypus, I learn something new. You know,
Griffiths samples thousands of water sites for various reasons.
I think I've seen platypus on maybe half a dozen occasions. It's why we don't have much information on them, because if you don't see one, it doesn't mean they're not there. It just means you haven't seen them on that particular time. So, and this is why, you know, other techniques like eDNA are incredibly important.
eDNA, that stands for environmental DNA. That's when someone collects DNA that animals shed in waterways to obtain a wide range of information.
And it's enabled us to be able to do projects on this kind of scales that have never been possible before.
Last year, I signed up our family for the Great Australian Platypus Search, or GAPS. The massive 2,000-site data collection effort fills the gaps by showing where platypuses live. Searching for platypuses in the 21st century is less romantic than it sounds. There are no night vision goggles, no special platypus stocking boots. Volunteers called citizen scientists visit waterways during platypus mating season. They use big plastic syringes to push water through special DNA collecting filters. A lab then analyzes the filtered eDNA to identify any vertebrates in the water.
So the idea being that we need to push through as much as we can until it's just physically not possible to do it anymore. Your filter's completely full of DNA.
Kristen Lees of the Corangamite catchment organizes citizen scientists for all kinds of ecology projects. Today, she demonstrates how to test for platypuses.
I could only do that, and I couldn't push anymore.
I team up with volunteer Bernadette Cheeseman. We filter water from the Yarrowee River. Kookaburras laugh at our progress.
Now, you know what else?
At man-made Lake Wendouree, we observe school students, black swans and their cygnets ambling along the shore, but no platypuses. The next week, when our family's testing kits arrive in the mail, my son Xavier reads from the instructions.
From all of us at the Great Australian Platypus Search, we want to thank you for your active participation as a citizen scientist.
The boys and I pack the car for our trip. Forecasters are warning of a massive rainstorm. We drive west.
In 400 meters, at the roundabout, take the third exit.
Past miles of dry-stacked volcanic rock walls and windbreaks of eucalyptus and cypress. Expansive fields of grazing cows, sheep, and a mob of emu are dwarfed by the gleaming white turbines of a new wind farm. At the first sight, we drop our bucket over the bridge railing to the roar of passing lorries.
Cool.
Bees swarm high in a tree. A colorful itsy-bitsy spider jumps on our bucket.
Wait, stop. It's a peacock spider.
It's a peacock spider.
But we see no platypuses. Volume of sample one was?
Volume of sample one was 565.
We enter our filter quantities on the GAPS app. It also asks us to assess the area's habitat, like burrowing possibilities and vegetation. Livestock access means a muddy river and eroded banks. Humans can complicate platypus habitats by building stuff where platypuses live or diverting their water. At the next location, I park as close to the water as I can. It's in the middle of a road construction site. Two workers greet us.
Probably got a good spot to stop here though, mate.
Okay.
Yeah, because you're in between the traffic lights.
Okay, so how far?
Well, you're probably best to go the other side of the lights and turn right up in here.
Okay.
Where our stack site is, and then have a walk down there, yeah.
Got it.
No worries.
Thanks.
The water is relatively clear despite the construction.
Yes.
No obvious signs of platypus here either. We finally reach our last intended waterway. The long red dirt road leads to a one-lane bridge nearly enveloped by rolling green hills. It feels like we're in another country. There is nothing around. Except hundreds of sheep. They beat a noisy retreat. Within minutes, they look like grains of rice on the hills. Thunder claps as we finish our last samples. Then the rain begins to fall. Sampling mission accomplished, but no platypus sightings. What we have is DNA from five creeks in Victoria, five of 2,000 sites. It sounds like a disappointing drop in the bucket. My youngest son reflects.
They're gonna know that that exact spot, what type of animals were there or what type of animals were not there. So actually everyone's making a difference. So it's like,
we mail our difference-making samples to Josh Griffiths, the expert. It will take discernment and wise stewardship to move forward and protect the vulnerable platypus.
Turn right, then you will arrive at your destination.
Reporting for World, I'm Amy Lewis in Geelong, Australia.
Today is Tuesday, January 11th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Here now is world commentator Steve West on calculating probabilities in dice and marriage.
My wife is a gamer. I mean that in a very limited way. She doesn't binge in front of the Xbox playing Call of Duty Black Ops, though I expect she would do quite well. No, when we go out to lunch or dinner and wait for our meal, the backdrop of our conversation is often a game of Yahtzee played on my smartphone. Pass and play. She's competitive and yet gracious, whether winning or losing. I'm not. Competitive, that is. I lose too much. I do try to be gracious. Hey, you're almost winning, I say as we wait on pizza. What do you mean? We're tied. Well, you're almost winning. One more point and you will win. I'm almost winning too. She smiled. The man and woman in the next booth stare at us. They're sitting on the same side of the booth, unusual, and they are not smiling. I look back at the game. On the hundreds of occasions we have played this game, the words permutations and combinations always come to mind. A door opens on my 10th grade algebra class in which I studied these concepts. My eyes sweep the class and go right to the large and open windows that look out on a flagpole. Its rope snaps in the wind, and the ring that holds it clangs against the pole. I have only the vaguest notions of what the words mean. I think the sound of the phrase permutations and combinations was what I enjoyed. It's assonance. Your turn, my wife says. I roll a 6, 5, 3, 2, and 6. I'm thinking, what are the odds I will roll another 6 to give me 3 of a kind? But I have 2 rolls. If I save the 2 6s and roll again, what are the chances that one of my 3 rolling dice will be a 6? What are the chances that all will be 6s? Should I save the 2 6s or roll all 5 of them again? My head hurts. Are you going to roll? She asks. I'm thinking this has something to do with permutations and combinations, but I have no idea. I roll all 5. No 6s at all. What are the odds? Soundly defeated, I vow to look up permutations and combinations when I get home. Turns out, Yahtzee has nothing to do with permutations, where sequence matters, but it has everything to do with combinations and probability. For example, the odds of rolling all of one number on the first roll of the dice, you yell Yahtzee here, is 1 out of 1,296. That's discouraging, of course, and utterly useless. Mr. Wizard is not playing Yahtzee. Besides, the pizza's here. A few mouthfuls later, she won again. You almost won, she generously said. Essentially, we tied. I smile. She won by 2 points. I think that unwillingness to trumpet victory is called parity of hearts, or maybe oneness. What are the odds of that? I'm Steve West.
Tomorrow, redistricting will find out how the new congressional maps could affect this year's midterm elections and how a ransom payment for kidnapped missionaries might affect gospel work going forward. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichert. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Go now, in grace and peace.